So. Alright, so let's go ahead and get started. Just a reminder that we have our first exam Thursday, and it'll be at 8 a.m. this morning. So I get to see you coming in with your coffee on the magazine. We have a Q&A session Wednesday, October 3rd at 6:15. That's on 115 Harkness. And I hope most of you come in. I know probably everybody came on these things, but sorry about that. The spirit of that is ask whatever you want. I will try to answer in, you know, as much in full as I can. But it's not really a review session. Okay, so if you have specific questions, that's a really good time to bring it up. And then Thursday we'll have lecture as usual, and I will be giving you a problem set that we do next week, which will be a little long because we skipped one this week. So, okay? Any questions about all that? So you're welcome to bring an 8.5 by 11 inch sheet of paper with anything you want written on one side of it, okay? And bring a calculator. I probably don't have to tell you guys this, but make sure the sines and cosines and powers of 10. Okay. If in the midst of the test you need an integral, ask me for it if you don't know how to do it. That's not the point of the test, okay? So you don't really need to duplicate the integral table on your sheet of paper. Any questions about how that'll work? Okay. So last week, I posted some lectures for you. Did that go okay? Okay, good. Because I can arrange to have guest lectures, but that just raises a whole different set of issues. So I usually find this actually works better. So I'll just hit the highlights. I mean, we talked about friction last week, and so if we have something that's moving, in the real world, there'll be a force of friction that may oppose its movement, unless you're told that you have a frictionless surface between the motion, and you assume that you have a force of friction. This opposes the motion, and if this thing is heavier, you can expect the friction to be larger. So the force of friction is proportional to this normal force. And then we have this constant proportionality that basically describes what's happening in these surfaces, and it can be different depending on the material. So if it's Teflon, you expect it to be a much smaller number than if it's sandpaper. So this is generally pretty straightforward to use. If you have something that's not moving and you're pushing on it, and that certainly can happen, right, then what you have is that you may be applying a force to it, but it's not moving. So the force of friction is exactly equal and opposite to the force that you're applying. Otherwise, there'd be a net force and the thing would be moving, right? So you can push, and there's a threshold. You push, you push, you push, and if you push just hard enough, it begins to move. So I'm sure you've all experienced that. And so if at that particular threshold, then you have the force of friction is equal to this force of static friction times the normal force. Again, you have a proportionality to the normal force that's heavier, etc. This again describes, you know, the situation. The surface is very particular to the given situation. But note that this force of friction does not have to be equal to that threshold value. That's the largest that it can be. So this is the subtle point of friction. This is the one where I'll get some fraction of you on the test. I guarantee you I'll put it in somewhere. And basically, if you see that it's not moving, it does not necessarily mean that the force of friction is equal to mu sub s times m, right? That's the largest it can be. So usually, you will find when you want to use this particular threshold value, you'll find the problem has some form of awkward wording to it. It's like find the maximal value that this can have, such and such can happen. Or something. It would be some sort of threshold condition that you can see in English. So just watch out for that. That's sort of the subtlety. So another thing we talked about was circular motion, which turns out to be really useful for us. So the way to think about it is that Newton's first law holds true. Right? Newton's first law, remember, is that a body in motion will maintain its motion unless acted on by a force. That means if an object is moving this way, it will go straight unless there's a force on it. So if something's going to move in a circle, it has constantly got a force toward the center. Okay, and we call that force the centripetal force. F equals ma, so we say that there is a centripetal acceleration toward the center. And I sort of did a bit of a derivation for you last week. I'm certainly not going to bore you with it again. But basically, that centripetal acceleration, when you look at circular motion, is equal to the magnitude of this tangential velocity divided by the radius squared. And this is something that's not so crazy if you think about it. If you're in a car and, I don't know, you're running from the cops or something and you're having to do some wild turn around some curve, then if you're going really fast, when you turn, you get thrown toward the side a lot more than you do if you're going slow. Right? Why? You're not thrown toward the side, actually. What's happening is the car is being held by the tires on the road, you're turning, so the car accelerates this way. And you begin to accelerate that way only because the car is pushing on you. And that's what feels to you like you're thrown to the side. So we often, in English, call that centrifugal force. There is no such thing, actually. Right? There's only centripetal force toward the center. Okay, I lied. There is such a thing. And I'll say this once, and then I want you to totally forget about it. If we transform ourselves into the coordinate system that is moving around the circle, and you want to understand the fact that you're getting thrown against the side of the car, then you make a fictitious force which operates against the force toward the center that balances things out so that you stay on the circle. And that fictitious force is called the centrifugal force. That's where you get the word centrifuge, and that's the idea. You spin this thing around in the centrifuge, and things that are heavier get sort of thrown toward the backside. So if you can see it in this weird frame of reference. But I think it's enormously confusing. If you see a book that talks about centrifugal force, throw the book away and don't ever look at it again, because it means that that author has a really sorry sense of judgment, in my opinion. Okay, so forget centrifugal force now. Newton's first law, you go in a straight line unless there is a force toward the center. That force we call the centripetal force, okay? And it always operates to bring you toward the center. And I cannot conceive I don't think there's a situation in this class where you will need to transform yourself into the frame where you're going. Okay? So, if a problem tells you you have circular motion, this is true and that is true. Period. If for whatever reason you see this is true and that is true, you know you're on a circle. Okay? Now, this is useful in a way that maybe, I don't mean to mislead you, okay? Imagine, I think you probably don't have to worry about this so much, but imagine if you're in a car and you're sort of driving down the road like this, and you really want to analyze that motion. Well, every time you go around a curve, you can imagine the motion of that curve being instantaneously on the circle. Okay? So even though circular motion may seem like a very special case, you can actually analyze this curvilinear motion in terms of a lot of different circles and get a pretty good idea of what's going on. So it's a very useful sort of thing. So any questions about circular motion or friction? Last week's stuff in general? Okay. So where I want to go now is to start talking about work and energy. And I guess I started that a little bit last week. I think you have to be a little bit careful not to be led too much by English definition of work or energy in a sense, because in physics we have very particular definitions of work. I know that most definitely if I'm walking around carrying something like this, I feel like I'm doing work, and there's no question you're doing biological work to hold this thing up. But in physics, you don't do work unless you actually exert a force through a distance along the direction of that force. Okay? So that's our definition of work. Or you could think of having moved through a distance, what component of the force goes along that direction, and if you multiply that component of the force, the magnitude of it times the distance moved, you also get a measure of the work. Okay, so the very particular definition. Note that it is also very strange in that, we've all known lazy people, but have you actually ever known anybody can do negative work? My brother's close. We all have one, right, in the family. But you really can, in physics, do negative work, right? Because I can exert a force on something and it can be moving the other way. And so my component of force is actually that way. It is moving this way. And so the cosine of this angle, which is what projects out this piece of the force that's perpendicular and that is along the other vector, the other piece, this cosine can be negative. So that turns out to be pretty important. So mathematically, what we do to project out this piece of one vector or one, toward the other. I mean, basically we have two vectors, right? We have a force, which is a vector because it can have a magnitude and direction, and you move a distance, which means you're moving with a magnitude and a direction that's very particular. So these are both two vectors, and for any two vectors, you can look at an angle between them in the plane that forms that the two of them form. And if you look, for example, at the component of the force that is in the direction of this other vector, it's the magnitude of it is the magnitude of F times the cosine of the angle between them. So that cosine projects out this piece. And it doesn't actually matter whether I look at the component of the F along D or the component of D along F. I just end up with this cosine theta there. Okay? So so that's what the cosine projects out, and that's really just a formula that you get when we consider the idea of multiplying two vectors. So we're going to see two different ways of multiplying vectors. And this is the first way. And we call this vector multiplication. Basically, you can think of work as force times distance, but you have to really be careful about this little directional piece. So what we like to do is to take these two vectors, a force and a distance, and multiply them together. And then we would like to have something in that multiplication that projects out the components so that you have one vector multiplied by the component of the other vector along the other. So we generally say that if we have two vectors, they'll form a plane, right? There's no way that you can avoid having the two vectors form a plane unless they're collinear. If you look at the angle between them, now, you may argue this is also an angle between them, okay? But the way this works is you want to consider in the plane, you want to look at the smallest angle between them. That's what we really call the opening angle. And we say that A dot B, or the scalar product of the two vectors, is equal to the magnitude of A times magnitude of B times cosine theta. And it doesn't actually matter what order you take them. A mathematician would say that it's commutative algebra. And note that we take these two vector quantities, and what we end up with is a magnitude times a magnitude times a magnitude. So you have a number in the end. And so that's one of the things you get out of this particular sort of quantity. And this is another way to calculate it, which I think I went through last week for you. Okay, and it's fairly easy to remember. You just take the components of each of the vectors and multiply them by each other and then add them together and just give you a number. And I proved that last time before, actually. You won't need to prove it or anything like that. I just wanted to make sense to you. Okay, so just remember that this takes two vectors and multiplies the component of one that's parallel to the other, right? But it can be parallel and in the opposite direction, and that's when you get this cosine theta negative, and you get negative sign. Okay? You're going to use this out the wazoo, so just get used to it. In particular, where it applies to what we're talking about is in work. Imagine that I have a particle that is moving in some random path as a function of time, and I'm going to describe that path at any given moment by a vector which I'm calling S of t. Okay? So this is a general three-dimensional vector, and it would have components, S of t, Y of t, Z of t, and so on. But here's the particle at some given time. Now, independently in this problem, whatever it is, we can imagine that there is a force on this particle. Don't know what the direction is. I've drawn it in a very particular direction. I didn't mean to put 90 degrees here necessarily. Okay, there is a force on this particle. That force can change its direction at any moment, at any time, right? So there's some force as a function of time, some S as a function of time. And the particle moves from, say, some initial point to some final point. And if we want to define how much work is done on that particle by that force, well, let's think about it for a moment. It's sort of hard to imagine, right? Because these vectors are constantly changing directions. So how do I really project one on the other? That's not so easy to do, because what we've learned to do is to take one vector and multiply it by the other. Now they're changing as a function of time. So the way to deal with this is to consider just a little tiny section of this motion, okay? And if I imagine just looking at this little tiny section, then here's the path, and here's our particle in this little tiny section. And because we choose that tiny section to be so little, I'm going to say that it is a distance ds. And because it's a differential distance, that vector is going to be constant over that differential distance. Even though the global curve is changing, I pick such a tiny piece of it that it looks like it's straight in that little bit. So I have a little vector here, dx. And over that little short distance, because it's only gone a tiny little ways, it's also over a little short time, which means that time is so short that the force at that moment is constant. All right? So the force will be in some direction, whatever it is according to the function at that point. So I have a force here. Because I've chosen this differential little piece of element of the motion, I can think of this ds and the f as constant vectors. And now I know how to handle those. I know that at that very moment, over that particular piece, there's a differential amount of work that gets done, which is equal to the vector F dotted into dx. Because that gives me F times dx magnitude times the cosine of the angle between them, which in this case would be, here's my dx, here's my F, and there's the angle between them. Okay? So that piece I hope is straightforward, because we choose the differential piece, and over that we have two fixed vectors, and I know how to handle work. Okay? But it's differential work because I'm choosing just this tiny little piece. Now we have to sum an infinite number of those to get the full path. So the total work it takes to go from the initial point to the final point here is the integral over dw from the initial to the final. We're just summing up the dw's over all these little pieces. So that's the integral from the initial point to the final point of f dot ds. And that then is the full amount of work going from the initial to the final point. And that, in physics, is the actual definition of work. Or whatever the path happens to be. So now, just add problem and go. Any questions on the basic concept here? Usually, not always, you'll find this to be sort of a discrete path. You'll move so far one way, so far another way, so far another way. Or there'll be something in there that, makes this sort of manageable. Yes?
So if we have problems like this, what would you give it to SMT and FT?
Usually what you'll get is some path and some function of force I could in principle give you, and I could make that arbitrarily hard. I won't, but I could, right? In principle, but every time you throw up an integral, it could be arbitrarily nasty, right? So we're not going to be doing that. But conceptually, just understand, it's basically force times distance, project out that piece. That's what gives you the dot product. And then this whole integral crap just comes in because you want to allow them to move with time and everything. So you go to a tiny little piece where they're not moving. Then you know what to do, and then you sum it up, and that's the integral. They don't tell you that shit in calculus because that makes it too easy. Right? So, I actually hope that many of you are looking at that and begin to figure, that's what an integral really is. Because at least that's the way it worked for me. I didn't understand why we go like that. And sort of it's when you start to see it actually being used and see that it has to be used this way. But I can't just multiply force times the distance here because that's only valid over that very small moment because they're different as they go. Okay? So you have to have this general case. Alright, so let's just do a quick example. Let's say for example that you have a climber going up a cliff carrying a camera or a backpack, okay? So the climber climbs straight up the cliff carrying a backpack, then traverses across a little ways on the cliff, straight across, and then goes back down. And let's say that the climber climbs up a distance H, traverses a distance D, and goes back down a distance H. So that's our particular path for this example. But note that we really have three discrete pieces in this problem, right? So Yeah, now, of course, you can say the work is equal to the integral, you know, from this point to that point, delta ds. That's not particularly useful, although we can do that. If you stop and think about it, what you really have are three pieces here, right? You've got one piece here where the force and the distance have orientations and are sort of fixed in their orientation and magnitude. You have one here where the force and the distance are fixed in their directions and magnitude. And you have one here where they're fixed in their directions and magnitude. So this integral breaks up into three discrete pieces. So you can imagine now having it be the sum of each of these three different pieces. Where this is f dot ds, or this piece is f dot ds, or that piece is f dot ds over that piece. And so now we have to analyze each of those three pieces separately. So let's look at segment one. In segment one, what's happening? You have, let's say the backpack, just for simplicity, has mass. Okay, so you have the climber lifting the backpack all the way up the cliff. Okay, so if we look at, here's the backpack, and really I actually blew it, and I have to specify what I'm actually asking you to find here. What I would like to calculate is, what is the total work done by the climber on the backpack? In each segment. And in total. And that wording may sound a little bit awkward. What was the work done by the back climber on the backpack? Okay. You really have to pay attention to that phrasing, and we'll see why, and then we'll come back to that. Let us now consider the backpack, because what we're trying to do is figure out how much work was done on the backpack. So what we want to consider is, what is the force on the backpack? So the climber exerts a force on the backpack, which is up. We have the force of gravity, which is down. I'll call that C, because it's not centripetal force. I'll just say that F. So F climber. If we say that the climber is not, you know, some Superman, so it's not accelerating up the cliff. So you can imagine that it is a slow or constant velocity. Why do I care? I mean, if I gave you this problem on an exam, I would very carefully put that caveat in there that the climber climbs up the cliff slowly or at a constant rate. Why do I care? Yeah, the minute I allow acceleration to happen, I don't actually know much about this force unless I specify very specifically the acceleration. So if I tell you that the climber is going up slowly, then what I'm really telling you is the climber's not accelerating. Therefore, at any given moment, this F is equal to mg, that there's no net force on this backpack, right? It's not accelerating. So that's the sort of the code word. You have to get your little decoder rings and sort of learn to translate the phrases and the word problems into exactly what it means mathematically. And that's part of the fun of doing physics, okay, especially the first time. And it's one of the things that makes it hard to teach and have some sympathy for your TA, because when you learn what these little code words mean in these problems, it becomes very automatic. So you just read it and you know what it means. And it's one of the things that makes it very hard to try to help students who aren't used to that, because what's making it hard is you've not seen it before, so you don't know how to decode it, right? So sometimes you just have to be careful of that. Anyway, so I would specify something like the climber is moving slowly, so that means F is equal to mg. So that tells you what force is, okay? And in this particular segment, the integral of F dot ds is equal to the integral of, well, the force is going up, and ds is going up because the hiker is moving straight up. Right? So they're in the same direction. They're in exactly the same direction, right? They're not, they're collinear. So that means the theta is 1. So this becomes F times dx. And note that they're no longer vectors, because I just took the dot product when I considered the direction. They're now magnitudes. The force is constant. It's just mg. It pulls out of the integral. I'm taking the integral over path 1 of dx. That's like the integral of dx. That's just x, okay? And it didn't go from the initial state to the final state, but I know that distance is just h. So if I just add this length up, which is all this integral is now, I get mgh. You okay with that? In this case, because things are constant over that little piece, you know the force is mg, and you go a distance h, and you don't really have to think your way through the integral. And I'm fine. Once you really realize what you're doing here, you just take the shortcut. But just be careful. Okay? And one of the reasons I want you to be careful is because of the next step. If we do this piece, number 2, the integral of f dot ds, now we have a different situation. The backpacker is traversing slowly. The backpacker's force, the climber's force on the backpack is still straight up. And it still opposes gravity, mg, which is down, right? And yes, you can argue that the backpacker has to, or that the climber has to accelerate at some point to start moving sideways. And if you start thinking like that on the exam, you're totally screwed. Because it's true. I'm not going to argue with it. But you're sort of letting the trees get in the way of the forest, and the forest in the way of the tree. You're making it too complicated. You're twisting it in a knot. Okay? What we do try to do is we try to sort of simplify things so we can think our way through it. So if you find yourself thinking sort of an impossible something like that, well, I know they're accelerating, all of a sudden this problem starts really being hard. Raise your hand and just ask me. Okay? And I will clarify that for you. Alright, so when I say they move slowly, yes, they had to start moving there somehow, but basically the way to think about it is the climber is moving slowly this way, the backpack is always being supported against the force of gravity, so F is up, mg is down. What's important is F on the backpack, okay? But what's ds? Ds is that way. It's at right angles. The dot product is 0. Okay? So there is no loop going perpendicular to the force. And that's why the waiter is doing no work in physics. Okay? They may be tired at the end of the day, but there's no work as far as physics is concerned. I suggest you don't use that as an excuse. Okay, so the dot product is 0. So this is just plain 0. Alright. Then we do the last piece. And now you have the integral of f dot ds. And now what's going on? What's the direction of the force now?
Slowly.
climber is going down from the bottom of the cliff, what is the direction of the force on the back path? It's not accelerating. So at any given moment, the backpack's going where there's a net force of gravity down and net force of, and you have to support it against gravity. So even though the backpack is going down, the climber is having to observe a force on it which is going up. Otherwise, the backpack drops to the ground and accelerates, right? So that's a little subtlety there. So always keep in mind, and this is one of the reasons why it is very important to keep in mind who is doing work on what in this problem. What we're asking is, what is the work done on the backpack? So you have to ask, what is the force on the backpack? So the force of gravity is down, the force of the climber is up. Okay. And the work done by the climber. So in this case, we have, as strange as it may seem, even though it's going down, force is up, ds is down. They're now in opposite directions. Cosine theta is negative 1. So this integral becomes minus mg integral ds, which is just h. So it's minus mgh. Okay? So that would be the answer for each of the three segments. And then you say, what is the total work? And it's equal to mgh for the first segment plus 0 for the second segment plus minus mgh for the third segment for 0. Everybody's the stupid backpack. All the way up the cliff and back down, and you're telling me to climb and do the work. Yeah, that's exactly what we want. According to the definition. Right. So, the net change in the height is 0. Note that if the net change in the height were not 0, let's say this was h1 and this was h2 and they're different, then this number is not 0. It could be positive, could be negative, depending on which is bigger. Okay? So this is an illustration of a very particular type of system. And we say that that this is a conservative system. Now, politics is all the order of the day these days, but this has nothing to do with politics. Any force where the energy in the system only depends on the endpoints of where it is, it's called a conservative system. We're going to come back to this a lot, so if that didn't make any sense, we'll try to make it make sense soon. Gravitation is called the conservative force. And I think I'll just let that go for the moment, and we'll come back to it as we see more examples. And then I think what we mean by conservative will start to make some sense. Okay, so energy we've defined as the ability to do work. Okay? So one of the things I mean when I say I have a conservative force is that I can exert a force on the string, take it through a distance, and when I do, the string is exerting a force on this, so it's doing a mgh, basically, worth of work to raise this thing up, okay? And when it's up there, Okay. When it is up there, we say that it has potential energy, because we define energy as the ability to do work. And I think sometimes it's not so obvious exactly why that's necessarily the case. But I mean, I think of it as sort of something as silly as, if by virtue of the position of this, it has the potential to do work, which means it has the potential to make a force times a distance. I mean, literally, you can visualize, it can exert a force on the nail through a distance, right? And you've done work. So clearly, if I just leave it sitting there, it's not going to do anything to that nail. So it has it's not imbued with energy in the scales that we're talking about at that point. So if I lift it up, it can do work. Okay, so we're going to talk a lot about sort of the potential to have energy, or the potential to do work a lot in this work. And energy can take a lot of different forms, and it's not always so obvious that it's, that, you know, that it's like this. But sometimes that might be a useful way to think about it. Okay, so let's imagine that we have a cart and we've got somebody is pushing this thing, okay? Just across the floor. And let's say that it goes a distance D. Starting from rest. So we know this person is exerting some force F, this direction. So F is equal to MA. And if we say that force is constant, let's not worry about friction. That force is constant, then we know that we can use constant acceleration equations. And we also know, by our definition of work, that the work done will be equal to the force times this distance D. Okay, there's no changes in direction or anything like that in this problem. And we can use the constant A equations. So that means that V squared is equal to V0 squared plus 2A times the distance it goes, which is just D. And V0 is 0. So V squared is equal to 2A times the distance. A is equal to F over M. F times D is the work done by the guy on the car. So what you see is that the work is equal to 1/2 times M D squared. And in physics, work and energy are really just two faces of the same thing. So you can look at this problem, and this person is doing work, and in doing so, at the end of this distance D, what they've done is they have conveyed energy to this car, which has a value of 1/2 mv squared. And that energy is totally tied up in the motion of the car. So we call it kinetic energy. And although we looked at a very particular example to sort of drive this 1/2 mv squared, the kinetic energy, which is sort of the energy of motion is defined as 1/2 m mean squared of classical fluid. Okay? Let's do another little example. Let's say that I have a book and I just lifted up the distance h. We've actually already done this one. I lifted up the distance h. I know that there's a force mg down, so the force that I have to lift on it, lift it up, is this mg in order to get it up. Once it's up, now I'm going to let it go. All right, and just let it drop. So the book is up here. I let it drop. Let's assume there's no air friction or anything. And so this thing now drops and slams back down onto the floor or whatever it is. We can calculate the velocity at this point. What's the velocity when it hits the floor? It's in free fall, so it's just got one force on it, mg, as it goes from the top of the motion down to the bottom because of distance h. So we can use our constant acceleration equation. Again, we can use the same one. V squared is equal to V0 squared plus 2A, and this time it's distance h. V squared is equal to 2GH, because G is what A is at that point. If I multiply psi by 1/2 times m, I get 1/2 mv squared is equal to 1/2 times m times 2gh, which is just mgh, which we already know is the amount of work that you do to lift it up. The force you exert times the distance is mg times h, because we already did that from the back half. So what you see here is that if I do an amount of work on this thing and then let it go, as it falls, that gets converted into the kinetic energy. And those two are exactly equal. So I can sort of have this cycle. If I'm really a boring person, I can imagine sitting there and picking this book up and dropping it all day long. And when it's at the bottom, it has pure kinetic energy, and then I lift it up, and up here, it has a potential energy. The kinetic energy is 1/2 mv squared. The potential energy is mgh. And it doesn't matter if I take this book and I walk it over here and I drop it. If I lift it up to a certain height and I drop it, this is true. If I lift it up and move this way and drop it, it doesn't change anything. If I move this way and drop it, it doesn't change anything. And what I mean in all this is that it is path independent. All it depends on are the two endpoints. Okay? And that happens to be a very special aspect of the force of gravity. And it's what I mean when I say that we have a conservative force. I think intuitively the way to think about it is that the energy flow from sort of one point to another is something that makes sense. All right. I put work into something, I give it potential energy, it turns into kinetic energy, but the work is equal to the potential energy, which is then equal to the kinetic energy at the bottom. And there's nothing that sort of complicates things that you don't know anything about. If I have air friction or something going on, and I don't know how to quantify it, it becomes complicated. And so, sort of, it's complicated, then it's not a conservative force, because then it depends on things, right? If I'm in a swimming pool, and I lift the book up, I'm underwater, and I lift the book up, and I'm moving it this way, well, I'm having to exert force to move it through the water, and so I'm actually exerting work on it. So it just changes things. So gravity by itself is a conservative force, and so that's one of the reasons we're going to study this system in another. And it's very easy to sort of, when you have a conservative force, the sum of the energy in the initial state is equal to the sum of the energy in the final state. Actually, this is always true. If the force is conservative, you can think your way through this very easily. Sometimes this is not so easy to do. Right, if in the real world, I take the book and it slams on the floor, some energy goes into other forms, right? I have some friction that's involved, I have some sound waves produced, I have lots of things going on. So the truth is, it's not such a simple system. So we're making approximations when we tell you, when we look at this. But, so this is always true, this energy conservation. The form of them may change. So, okay, let us try in one of these things. If you've got your PRS, if you're quicker. If your intent is to mess with this kid, you have your choice of different sliding modes. Okay. Very gentle. Pretty steep. Straight down. In the bird. Yeah. Obnoxious kid. Okay. So then the question is, in which case is the velocity the largest? So this is one. So I guess we have letters. Those will be A, B, C, or D. Five to 21. Seeing straight down, basically dropping the kid. Almost certainly no sense. All right, so we have many of you saying B, so you think it's irrelevant. Lots of you saying C. You think the kid will go faster or straight down? Okay. I did not specify clearly that it should have, but the height of each of these is the same. Okay, so that's pretty off. But what it means when you say you have a conservative force is that it only depends on the impulse. If the height difference is the same in each case, that amount of potential energy, okay, that kids have at a certain height is converted into the kinetic energy, which is 1/2 mv². The mass is the same in all cases. So if it's a frictionless slide, then the speed with which the kid hits the wall or the ground is all the same. Okay? So in fact, you can make do with the slide that's in the playground already. I'm kidding. No, actually, I never did this one. Some of you know that you can actually ask. Okay, So that's a little bit what you mean when you talk about a conservative force. It doesn't matter. If I add friction to this problem, it is not a conservative problem. Then it matters. The path length, the normal force, it becomes a more complicated problem. Right? Okay. So do you believe in energy conservation? Do you believe in energy conservation? Brothers and sisters, we are here to learn what nature can do. What nature does through the gospel of Newton. So I'm asking you, do you believe in energy conservation? Be willing to show me your faith. I need one of you to step forth. So we have no true believers here. Oh, test 2 is going to be bad deal. Yo, all right. We got one. Brother, what's your name?
John.
Hi, John. Nice to meet you. All right, John. I want you to stand for that stool. Now, I want you to lean forward. No, not this. Is that there?
Oh.
Can you move? All right. No. Let's look this up. Never mind. I'm dropping it on that side. All right. You can just tip your head. Yeah, okay, that works. Yeah, that works. Now, if you just let that go, and then don't move, whatever it is.
Just let go. Amen.
Don't move. All right. Thank you, John. So, I taught this particular topic to an equivalent class at Yale University 1 year. And this really Yale student did that. It took me a moment, you know, to sort of process what they had just done. I had Teflon. And it gained more energy. It wasn't a conservative system at that point. Alright. So what we just had in practice was a conservative system, a simple pendulum, we call it, right? We lift it up, we give it a certain amount of energy, we let it go. That energy gets converted into kinetic energy at the bottom, here, all kinetic energy, 1/2 mv². That energy then is converted back up into potential energy. If, in fact, it were no friction with the wire and no air friction, then it would be to exactly the same height. And then it comes back. And if we had a circumstance where we had absolutely no friction, it would have just come up and touched his chin. Okay. But we have friction in the system, so you know that it came to about right here. So I mean, it was miles away, wasn't it, John?
Miles is pretty stretch.
Yeah.
Stretch.
It's a little scary, actually. I appreciate you being a good sport. So, okay. So, be a true believer in energy conservation. It does not mean you can always think your way through the whole problem, right? Sometimes, if you have friction involved or something, you cannot always make sense of it. So energy conservation is not going to always be something that you can pull out mathematically in a problem and make it useful. I'm going to come back to that again and again when we get into collisions and stuff. But let me drop that for the moment, because what we want to do right now is to study just conservative systems. So there's another really useful conservative system that we want to study, and that is the system of a spring. And I don't mean the water kind or the seasonal kind. I mean the slinky kind, the metal kind. Okay. So imagine that we have like a block. Let me not do the block yet. Imagine that we have a spring. So you draw a spring like so. If you let the spring go, imagine it's a fairly stiff spring. You don't really think of a slinky. Think more like something you might see as part of a spring. And I'm thinking of something on your automobile, but that's so stiff you probably can't do anything with it. So think of something in between a slinky and an automobile. Basically a spring that you can stretch and you can push in, okay? And if you imagine that, a spring, if you just let it be, it has a natural length, okay? So in this class, we will imagine that every spring we have has a natural lane. And if you are as rough on slinkies as I was, you know that if you take the spring and you stretch it too far, you can screw up that natural length. Okay, you can actually just bend the thing and distort it. We're not doing anything in that realm in this class. Okay, so when we deal with springs, they'll have a natural length, and we're going to stay in the realm where we compress it a little bit or we stretch it a little bit. Okay? And so they'll have this natural length. Now the thing about the spring is, if you can imagine, if you take a spring and you start to pull it, at first it's really easy, and then it gets harder and harder and harder, right? The same is true if it's a fairly stiff spring, you start to compress it, it's easy, and it gets harder and harder and harder, okay? And that, then, is the fundamental characteristic of the spring, which is that, let's imagine that we have a spring which has a natural length, and we stretch it out, and we ask what we attach a ball to it, and we stretch it out. What is the force on that ball? Well, if I pull the spring further and further out, there's a certain force which is pulling it back the way that it came, and it will depend on this length. Usually this natural length, actually we often call it X0 or L0 or something like that. And this distance, I'll say, is X minus X0 in this case, where X0 is this natural length of the spring. So note that it is not important how long the spring is, it is important to what extent you have stretched the spring from its natural length. And the force that this spring then will exert on this object is going to be proportional to this distance x minus x0. Okay? When you have a constant proportionality, when you have a proportionality, it means you can put in a constant proportionality. So f is equal to k x minus x zero, where k is a testament to the creativity of physicists. This is known as the spring constant. So it gives you the amount of force for how far you stretch it. And if you have a really stiff spring, then K is a big number. If you have a really small, weak spring, K is a small one. So this K characterizes the spring itself, okay? There's another little issue here. This is sort of in magnitude. Note that if I pull this thing out, if I pull the spring this way, the spring is pulling it back to where I started. If I'm at the natural length and I compress it, then the spring is pushing back to where I started. So the spring always exerts what we call a restoring force. Back to what I'll call the natural position, or where the spring has its natural length. So in order to mathematically specify that, right now we have a magnitude of force depends on how much you stretch or compress it. This quantifies how strong the spring is, and now we need to get the direction right. So note that if I were to put a minus sign in here, let me do this. So here's my spring. Let me define this to be the positive direction. If I stretch it out this way in the positive x, then I'm forced going in the negative direction. So if this distance is x0 and this is where I am at x, then x minus x0 is a positive thing. I want a negative thing for the force, so I put in a minus sign. If I go back the other way, then x now is over here. The natural length is here, so x minus x0 is a negative number. If I now have a minus sign in front of that, I have a positive number, and the force is pushing in the positive direction, which is what I want. So all of that was probably just to confuse you, but what I meant to do was to motivate this. As the fundamental equation governing the force of the spring. Okay? Now, if you're one of those naysayers and you're sitting there saying, Jesus, physics is so boring. I don't give a crap about springs. I never give a crap about springs. I never liked slinkies. Fine. You can say that if you want. But let me tell you. The first approximation, if you would like to describe a chemical bond, that's your law. What is a chemical bond? Right, I have a bunch of negative stuff surrounding a positive thing. I have another positive thing over here with a bunch of negative stuff. Right? We haven't done any of that last most of the physics, right? So, if I have more negative stuff here, this positive and that positive are sort of attracted toward the center. If they get too close to one another, then I don't have so much negative stuff in here anymore, and positive repel each other, and they go back. Okay? So, if you turn into a theoretical chemist, and you want to describe a chemical bond, for small separations, spring is a perfectly good way to do it. Quantum mechanical spring, we have to tell quantum mechanical spring. But basically, you can describe it as a spring. So as silly as this whole spring model may be, it turns out to be incredibly useful for a lot of things. There's another place where I'm going to give you just a heads up about it. If you take a spring and you have a frictional system and you push it and you let it go, it just goes back and forth. All right? And we're going to study the solution to that. It's called simple harmonic motion. Okay? And the cool thing about simple harmonic motion is that we can actually understand it. We can understand that this object goes back and forth. We understand the period and everything. If you want to imagine what a wave is, let us imagine that we're in an auditorium, a big stadium, okay? And if you all were to stand up, we'll do this, we'll get away with it, because I'm not kind of there. And you all sort of do this random sort of some harmonic motion, okay? If you all did this set without anything correlating you, it just looks like sort of random stuff, okay? But if you do something like, what makes it a wave in a stadium is if, for example, I start here and you begin doing the wave as I pass you. Okay, that provides a correlation to all the simple harmonic motions. So that then gives you a coherence, which you see as a wave. So waves turn out to be nothing but simple harmonic motion of particles in fixed places. Waves are incredibly important in the world. Sound waves, light waves, mechanical waves, etc. So it all sort of starts with a spring. So you cannot like springs if you want, but it'll turn out they're going to come back and bite you again and again and again. Okay? So get rid of springs, and I'll see you next time.